This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week we come to you from San Francisco and the St. Regis Hotel, one of my favorite cities in the world. In fact, I used to live here for many, many years. My next guest, somebody who knows San Francisco a little bit, maybe better than you do. She's the contributor to Time Out. Shoshi Parks, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
You're from the Bay Area.
I am.
So, I mean, I can actually call you a local.
I think that's
but
accurate.
But you started as an archaeologist.
I did start as an archaeologist, yeah.
And the transition happened to food and travel writing because?
Well, academia is a tough place, and I didn't really want to be there anymore. So I decided to take my love for history and put it into my other loves, which are food and travel.
Well, have you been able to incorporate archaeology into loving and learning about San Francisco as
well?
Oh,
absolutely, yeah. There's some really fascinating archaeology here, both sort of maritime era, you know, post-Gold Rush, pre-Victorian maritime.
Where do you find the maritime stuff?
You're going to find that down in what is now either Fisherman's Wharf, or actually more consistently, you find things in sort of the North Beach and Jackson Square area, which were filled in later with sediment to create those neighborhoods. But once they used to be the shore, so there was a lot of piers and such there.
Wow. Because look, there are a lot of piers today, and I'm not talking about Pier 39, which everybody knows. And by the way, you know, there's some great things to do over there. But I'm talking about before you even get there, if you're coming up around the Bay Bridge, right, those piers are really still working piers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people are, I think, surprised sometimes to find that there is still a really significant industrial portion to the city, but it's a little bit concealed. You wouldn't necessarily know it was there.
Although you go to one of these piers, and it's just like this dark, open pier, and what's next to it, like this a dive bar called the High Dive. Right?
Yeah, oh, the High Dive is fantastic, yeah.
All right, it's just sitting there, you go, what's that?
Yeah, just randomly placed, yeah. Yep, that's a classic.
Exactly. So when we talk about the class, that's truly a dive bar. I mean, it's right. What are your favorite dive bars here then?
Oh my gosh, what a good question. So some of my favorites, I can go just neighborhood by neighborhood.
Yeah.
In the Mission, one of my favorites is called the Lone Palm. That one's sort of has a little bit of a 70s...
Haight Ashbury?
No, I wouldn't say that so much as kind of a dinner club type of feel, but yet in a dive bar. It's sort of a strange combination of
that
things.
That would be a strange combination.
Yeah.
I love... Because when I first moved to San Francisco, I lived in Noe, which nobody even knew about.
Yeah.
But it had the best weather in town.
Yep.
Right? But in order to get to Noah, you had to get through Haight Ashbury.
Yeah.
And that was Jefferson Airplane time. And right?
And there's still a fantastic dive bar that's still kicking on Haight, which is called Obzomzoms. That's been there since, I want to say the 40s. I might be a little off on that. But it's got this great sort of horseshoe bar, dark red walls. It's a classic. I love that spot.
And of course, to get from where I was living to where I was working, you went through the Castro district.
Yeah, yeah. And the Castro, in terms of dive bars, I guess there's not all that much these days there in the Castro. It's
no, but you had the Castro Theater.
Oh my God. Yeah, gotta love the Castro Theater. Still a staple of anybody who visits the city or lives here.
So for somebody listening to the show who's never been here before, who's coming to visit you, what's the first place you're going to take them?
You know, I've been thinking about this a lot because I actually have family coming into town next week. So you're asking me the perfect question. So one of the places I absolutely love to take people to, I'm a history buff, so I'm more drawn to those historic spots. And one of my favorite places is called the Musée Mécanique. It's a little museum that contains all of, well, maybe not all of, but many of the early mechanized puppetry and games that came from what was once Playland, which was the amusement park on our beachfront.
Wow.
So this little museum used to be out on the beach, and they, a few years ago, moved it to actually Fisherman's Wharf area. So it's sort of the one thing in Fisherman's Wharf that people tend to miss because it's just in this little sort of building off to the side. But you can go in. It takes quarters to play these.
And they still work.
They still work. They're incredible. I mean, they're not, you know, their early mechanization of interesting scenes that at the time would have been fascinating for folks. I get such a kick out of them.
Okay, so you're gonna basically warehouse your family there.
Yeah, exactly.
And then where?
Then I think I always am a big fan of North Beach and everything in North Beach.
Totally walkable. Yeah, don't try to park your car there. It's not going to work.
Gosh, no, please don't. Nobody needs extra parking there or extra cars there. But everything from the church front, the famous church steps on which Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio had their wedding photos taken, to the jazz clubs at which...
By the way, speaking of Joe DiMaggio, yeah. A little known fact. In the 1989 earthquake,
yeah.
He was living here then. He was alive. And as everybody was racing out of their buildings, and his building was in trouble too, it was kind of slanting down, he was running out carrying bags and bags of $100 bills.
No.
Because he had made so much money signing baseballs for cash that he never declared. It was a little embarrassing.
I've never heard that before.
Shoshi, I'm going to give you my little quick tour that I like to take my friends on. And nobody's doing this tour, trust me.
Okay.
Nobody does this tour. When I was working for Newsweek here, I covered some pretty crazy stories. So where do I go? I go next to the St. Francis on Powell. I go across the street where there used to be a United Airlines ticket office and a phone booth. And that's where I was standing back in 1976 when Gerry Ford came out from speaking at the Foreign Affairs Council. And that's where Sarah Jane Moore took the gun and shot at him.
Oh, you're kidding.
The bullet is still in the wall there. I can show you the bullet hole.
Really?
Yep. That was a crazy day. I mean, crazy day. And 3 days earlier, I take my friends, if you want to go back to history, I take them over to Moore Street because that's where they busted Patty Hearst.
Ah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, right.
Those were very, very crazy days.
Yeah.
You know, and then down to Daly City where Patty got some loan money here. And I mean, you could actually do a Patty Hearst tour.
You totally can.
If you went up to by the Fairmont, her parents lived right across the street. And so we were always camped out there during the days that she was kidnapped and on the run.
Sure.
You know, there's so much of that story still here.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so we're back to your family coming.
Okay.
You take them to a museum that not many people know.
Yeah.
Where else are you going to take them?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so... I, in addition to being a big history buff, I'm a huge foodie. So we've got to focus on some food.
Yep.
The Cliff House and the Sutro Baths area, I think, is a fantastic place to go for people who have never been to the city, just to get a sense of how, you know, incredible that ocean is with the cliffs. The Cliff House has some great brunch options. I'm a big fan of their various Eggs Benedicts with crab.
Yes, you need to take a nap after that.
Yeah, you really
you
do.
You have to take a nap.
Not to mention all the free popovers that they feed you as you're waiting for your meal to arrive. And then right next to that are the Sutro Baths, which are the remnants of what was an original bathhouse,
a swimming area. If you go to the Cliff House, they have photos on the wall
of
the Sutro Baths.
Uh-huh,
and then you got an idea of what it really was.
Right. And the Cliff House itself has been there for well over a century. I think they're coming up on almost 150 years now. So so those two are quite intimately connected. And the Sutro Baths are now just ruins, but they're very interesting to me, at least.
And of course...
So that's where we'd start, I think.
There's a place that's known for inventing the Pisco Punch. I know it. You know it. The Buena Vista Cafe.
The Buena Vista Cafe. Well, actually... I don't mean to correct you, sir, but Buena Vista Cafe, that's the Irish coffee that they invented. The Pisco Punch, as far as I know, was actually invented at the Old Ship Saloon.
Really?
I might be making that up.
Wow, okay.
But Buena Vista is definitely known for that Irish
coffee.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the Pisco Punch is absolutely a San Francisco-born thing. Apparently, what made it so desirable back in the Gold Rush days was that they were infusing a bit of cocaine into the drink. Yeah, so not doing that these days, but...
You're sure?
I guess I'm not positive. But.
Okay, fine. Be that way. But the bottom line is what I love about the Buena Vista Cafe is you go there either as the beginning of your day or at the end of the day because then you can always hop the cable car.
Oh, yeah. And the cable car is a must do, I think, for those, especially who have never been to the city. And that's a great line because you get some spectacular views. Of,
well, because you're going up that hill.
Yep.
You're going up.
Going high.
You're going very, very high.
Yeah.
I know. What's the biggest surprise for you about this city?
Oh, well, you know, I think what continues to surprise me about this city is just how incredibly beautiful it is. I know that's kind of a cop-out in a way say that.
It is.
But, you know, I find that each neighborhood still, even though this city has changed significantly in the last decade especially.
Well, one of the big changes, because when I was here, what was off limits has now been developed. And it was the prime piece of real estate owned by the United States Army, mm-hmm. the Presidio.
The Presidio, yeah, that's right. Yeah, and now there's quite a bit more to do in the Presidio in terms of certainly around the main post where there are now several museums. They do a weekly, actually twice a week, they do an off-the-grid event, which are food trucks that are there at the main post. And they set up fire pits and, you know, there's a sort of bar type of situation as well. They have live music. So the
I love how you described it, a bar type of situation. Is that a police call? We've got a bar type of situation here.
Yeah.
Please send all units.
The place where you can order drinks, let's say that.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
And your favorite drink?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think I'm going to honor San Francisco and say that I'm a big fan of the Pisco Punch. Yeah. That's definitely a top drink for me.
And by the way, San Francisco is not a driving city, so you can actually go get a drink and not get in trouble.
That's true. I've had many nights walking home for simply that reason. Yeah.
Many nights walking. I won't even open the door to that. Okay, fine. We're talking to Shoshi Parks from Time Out. And yet, every time you look around here, there's another restaurant opening.
Yeah, we've got an incredible culinary scene, and it's just exploding right now. I mean, new spots are opening constantly.
Should there be a rapid change in cabin pressure, oxygen masks will automatically drop from the compartment above your seat, free of charge. And to start the flow of oxygen, pay your flight attendant $75.63. My mother, God rest his soul.
Think about this. San Francisco every year, as the 13th most populous city in the United States, also gets about 25 million visitors a year. My next guest can boast of getting about 850 of those, meaning 850,000 of those visitors a year, from an opportunity and an experience that, hard to believe, is 50 years old now. It's the Exploratorium, and he's the executive director, Chris Flink. How are you?
I'm great, Peter. Thanks for having me here. And yes, this is the Exploratorium's golden anniversary year, and we're celebrating in all sorts of ways, and very, very proud to be on the front doorstep of San Francisco for so many visitors like yourself.
Now, you're a New York transplant. You came out here for undergrad at Stanford, and then you stayed.
It's hard not to love the Bay Area, and your visitors and listeners, I'm sure, will have a great time when they're here. And you should know that the number one museum in San Francisco, according to TripAdvisor ratings from folks just like them, has us as the Exploratorium at number one.
Well, let's talk about the definition of a museum or an activity or an experience. I'm a big fan of being interactive. I'm a big fan of being participatory. That's what you guys do.
Yes, the Exploratorium's museum is one of science, art, and human perception. And I think the wonderful creative accomplishment of the organization...
By the way, I failed all those courses in school.
Well, the good news is our founder, Frank Oppenheimer, said, no one ever failed a science museum.
And, so there's hope for me.
There's hope. You will not fail your visit.
Nobody ever failed the science museum. That's good. I like that.
But we explore these important topics with really extraordinary hands-on learning experiences that don't just convey important information and spark curiosity, but they're a lot of fun. If you come, you'll see visitors having a great time with their families. People of all ages love our exhibits and our exhibitions.
I have to tell you this, and this is a true story and it's a fact. Every time there was open school night where the parents got to meet the teachers, as my parents would go to each individual teacher from chemistry, math, physics, the same question would be asked of my parents. Dr. and Mrs. Greenberg, you didn't really have a hope of your son becoming a chemist, did you? Good, because it's not going to happen. This one and every. So it got to the point where when one of the physics teachers wanted to demonstrate static electricity or centrifugal force, I was used as the model because he knew he couldn't. He had to do something with me. So you got to see my hair stand on its head or on its end or a bucket of water not falling out when you whipped it around the room. You have basically, on a very basic level, those kinds of experiences and more.
Many. We have roughly 650 hands-on exhibits on our floor today on Pier 15 in San Francisco. It's a wonderful adventure where the visitor can explore led by their own curiosity. And fundamentally, Peter, one of the things your own educational experience is pointing out is that particularly today with all the tools available to us, it's not about more information. The world needs more inspiration. We need young and older people alike to get excited about these topics, personally engaged in them, viscerally connected to these topics, because they're shaping everything from civic discourse to the job market of the future.
As my mother once told me, it's not about being interesting, it's about being interested.
That's right. We celebrate curiosity as one of the great forces in the world, and we like to stimulate it and turn it towards really important topics.
So if someone as challenged as I still am in these areas, what would you want to show me at the Exploratorium that I might actually learn from it and apply it in my own life?
Wow, there are really so many things. We, of course,
start with the basics because I'm an idiot. Okay.
Well, the first thing I'd say, Peter, is I would unleash you rather than lead you. I would encourage you to
you want me to sign the damage waiver?
To follow your own interest and your own curiosity and wander the Exploratorium. We try not to
because
be
I'm
directive.
Because I'm assuming you're going to deal with concepts in a different way. Yeah. You'll deal with gravity. You'll deal with electricity. You'll deal with all the things that we take for granted in our lives and break it down.
It's truly wonderful. We put what we think of as the scientific phenomena at the center of these experiences. So they appeal across ages because it's not a textbook unfolded on an architectural space, but rather a set of laboratory-like experiences where we really put forth the most charismatic phenomena. The ones you're talking about are from the worlds of the physicists, the physical
right.
sciences, you know, light, motion, sound. And we've got in Gallery 3 an extraordinary collection of those. We've also been really important, innovative work exploring the life sciences and the environmental sciences, and really interestingly, the social sciences, if you will, the human phenomena, how we interact with each other, cooperate, compete, sometimes acting not in our best individual or collective interest. These are really important concepts to understand where your own behavior becomes part of what you study.
Do I get to blow stuff up?
I had to ask the question. In a small scale, there's definitely a plenty of rambunctious energy that can be unleashed at the Exploratorium. We have about 160,000 field trip students coming from around the Bay Area every year, and it's one of the most popular destinations for such things. And again, I get countless stories wherever I go about adults who talk to me about how formative that was to them and how that created a trailhead for them to pursue their own learning in one topic or another. And if nothing else, at a very high level, it's a place where people often discover the joy of learning, which is really the gift that keeps giving. If you can learn a piece of content about light as a motion, light as a particle or light as a wave, that's okay. But what's really great if you can learn that learning these things is fun and joyful and something I am into doing.
I'm old enough to remember, and maybe you are too, I grew up watching a television show called Mr. Wizard with Don Herbert. And it was a Saturday morning show for kids that explained science, but he would do it in such a way that you would understand what happened if you touch this wire to that post and you go, got it, you know, or make a penny blow up or destroy some myths, right? Mm-hmm. I grew up with a myth, okay, and I'm sure you did this, that if you put somebody's tooth in a glass of Coca-Cola, it disappeared in a minute.
Yep.
But it didn't, or maybe it did, I don't know.
No, it did not.
It did not, okay, thank you.
But I think what you're describing is an inquiry-based approach, which is very core to our pedagogy. Our way of learning happening is to start with questions. We celebrate and honor the question much more than obsess about the answer. It's not about spreading answers. It's about taking you on a journey with science that's almost more like a verb than a noun. It's not the science in the textbook and we're going to spread the chapters out for you to read in your visit. It's science as an approach, you know, the scientific method. These are ways of thinking that are very powerful.
And in the search for common ground, if you can come up with a question that everybody's got in their mind but has never been answered, you've just hit a home run.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what you guys do. Yeah. How often are you open?
We're open on Pier 15 in San Francisco most every day. You can go to exploratorium.edu and get the specifics. Importantly, for adult audiences over 18, we're open every Thursday night as well for After Dark, which is a really exciting thing.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
I am a passenger.
Two people who live in the urban forest here are now my guests. How about that for a segue? The authors of 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die, Kimberly Lovato and Jill Robinson, welcome.
Thank you.
I mean, I used to, in the interest of full disclosure, I used to live in San Francisco. The biggest mistake I ever made was when I sold my house.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. I used to live in Noe Valley.
Oh, my goodness.
With the best weather in town, although I dream of living in Sea Cliff, but that's another story.
You could be retired by now.
Just by selling my house.
Exactly. Yes.
But the cool thing that I noticed when I first came to San Francisco, I moved up here from Los Angeles. I was working for Newsweek. And in Los Angeles, we have 86 separate incorporated cities in desperate search of a community. In San Francisco, you've got real communities and real neighborhoods, and it's such a manageable place. It still takes me, you know, 15 years to figure out how to get around in L.A. In San Francisco, I figured it out in about a week. And that's not to belittle San Francisco. That's how great it was and still great it is. But when I was first here, and I won't going to tell you what year that was, but when I first came here, the food scene was nowhere where it is today. I mean, not even close. You had a couple of places in Marin. You had a couple of very old restaurants like Tadich's and Sam. I mean, all those, you know, the old guard, right? And they had the old Italian places in North Beach. Things have changed, haven't they?
Oh, yes. Yeah, San Francisco. I think, you know, New Yorkers might disagree, but San Franciscans will argue they are the food capital of the U.S., but there's something for everyone here. And even those old guard places are still great to go. I still love Chipino at Tadich Grill, but there's so, I was just looking at a list this morning of new places to eat, and I just can't keep up.
Well, I found one last week called Angler.
Angler.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'm a big seafood guy, so anytime you can do that.
Oh, yes.
I know. But here's the thing. In New York, if you walk up and down the streets of Manhattan, on any given block, there are anywhere between 9 and 14 restaurants per street. There are 19,000 just in Manhattan alone.
Holy cow. Right?
I know. San Francisco's a little more under control.
It's a little more manageable on a scale wise, but I think San Francisco Travel Association told me a couple years ago that there are more than 3,000 restaurants here, but the city's a lot smaller than Manhattan too. So,
which is what I like about it. Exactly. Well, we'll talk about the food opportunities in a second, but let's talk about what's also changed in terms of, you know, people want to come to San Francisco and do the usual things, right? Got to go to take the tour of Alcatraz. You got to go across the Golden Gate. You got to go look at the Koi Tower. I mean, we can go down that list. You're going to look up and see the Transamerica building. I mean, what's new and different?
There are a lot of things. There are a lot of different ways to look at San Francisco history that aren't necessarily new, but new to people who haven't, you know, who only pay attention to the Golden Gate Bridge and Coit Tower. So if you think of the Barbary Coast Trail, that's not new, but that's something that as you follow the old history of San Francisco up in like Embarcadero area and Financial District, you're able to stop and read a lot of the history of the city that has disappeared, essentially.
Exactly. And the thing is this, if you just use San Francisco downtown as a base within 3 miles, just use it as hub, and you can walk it if you want to.
Yeah, easily, or hop on the cable car, but it is. I mean, San Francisco has a reputation of having a lot of hills, which it does, but since I drive a stick shift car, I know all the ways to get around avoiding the hills, and you can do it on foot, too. So.
And of course, how many times have you come down Lombard Street?
Many.
With a stick shift?
Yep,
okay,
sure.
And you've survived?
I've survived, and so have the pedestrians.
Although, in all fairness, the people who live there must be basically taking hostages by now because the traffic is out of control.
It's out of control, and there is some chatter now. I'm not sure if it's going to pass about charging cars to drive down, which I think is maybe not a bad idea.
Well, look what they've done in Venice. They're looking at a rule now to put turnstiles in St. Mark's Square.
Oh, is that right?
They tested that out last summer,
and
I think.
And it didn't exactly work very well.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
And there were no turnstiles.
No, but I mean, look, the bridge of size is actually the bridge of thighs. I mean, it's like everybody with their selfie stick. So in a way, before we talk about the cool things, can I suggest people that they try to avoid some of these places and figure out some newer places to go?
I think it's good. It's really difficult to tell someone, don't go to Golden Gate Bridge, because a lot of people really want to see that. But there are different ways to see it in different locations. So maybe going to the waterfront and walking along, you know, paths there, or having dinner with a restaurant that has a great overlook. That's a great way to see Golden Gate Bridge instead of walking across it. So
I think there are ways to
experience without avoiding necessarily.
What I used to do here is go biking by the old Safeway at the marina.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because it's just open space.
Yeah,
and it's great.
And Chrissy Field, that's what Jill was talking about. Yeah. Chrissy Field is, I mean, it's probably the best place to take a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge, too, because you can see the whole span, and you don't have to go across it unless you really want to. But
okay, here's a piece of trivia that you probably didn't want to know. San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge, of course, has been a capital of suicides for so many years. But here's the piece of trivia most people don't realize. Of all the people who have jumped off the bridge, only I think three of them jumped facing away from the city. All wanted that last view of the skyline.
That is interesting trivia, Peter. Where did you find that? And why didn't we put it in our book, Jill?
Aren't you glad I stopped by today?
Yes, no. Thank you for coming.
Isn't that interesting? That gives you an idea of the view that people still wanted to have on the way down.
On the way down.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that would have been pulled from our book by the publisher.
So.
You want to know something? Don't ever let them pull that information from the book because people need real information.
Yeah.
It's not just puffery. You got to tell the story.
That's right. Well, 100 things to do before you die.
All right. So
it's in the title.
Well, obviously, well, that would be the 101st because then you will die. I mean, let's call it what it is. But let's get serious for a second. You call it 100 things to do in San Francisco before you die. What's at the top of your list?
You know, that's sort of a misunderstanding of the book. We don't rank these. These are 100 things to do.
And I'm asking you to rank it.
Oh, rank it?
Yeah. What would you do? Okay.
It really depends on if you're a first-time visitor or a fifth-time visitor. So
let's start with the first time.
If I'm first-time, I would go to Crissy Field, as we were talking about, and see the Golden Gate Bridge. I would ride a cable car. I would go to the cable car museum because it's free and you can actually see the cables, the wheels that turn the cables, and it's kind of cool. It's this visceral experience.
What I love about San Francisco is not just the cable cars, but they kept the streetcars.
Yeah.
They kept the electric streetcars, and they've kept them the way they were in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the maintenance costs are out of control, but you know what? Keep it going.
Sure.
Exactly. But I mean, where would you take a cable car?
Oh, I love the Powell Hyde Street line is the best one because it has the best views. If you must go to Lombard Street, I mean, you talk about things to avoid. I don't really get the thrill of Lombard Street because unless you're driving on it, you can't really take a picture of it. But that's a great cable car line because it ends at the wharf.
I'm going to do my touristy thing here.
Okay.
I like that cable car line for another reason. You end up at the Buena Vista Cafe.
Exactly. Oh, yes. The Irish coffees.
Everyone wants to end up there.
I'm thinking I might stop there on the way. You want to join me?
No, and that's where they turn them around.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
Exactly.
What's the biggest surprise? When you were doing this book, what's the biggest surprise discovery you made?
Do you want to go?
Well, the surprise I had was something that Jill brought to the table. So when we were putting this book together, we had an Excel spreadsheet of about 200 or 250 things to add. But she brought Lotta's Fountain to the book, which I loved and I had passed by a million times but had never heard of. And Jill can tell you a little bit about what it is, but it's a existing living part of San Francisco's history that a lot of people have walked by a million times and probably don't even know.
Tell me more.
Well, it's only a couple blocks away from here. So it was
walking distance from the St.
Walking distance from the St. Regis. It's at the corner of Market, Geary, and Kearny Streets. Kearny looks like Kearney to people who aren't from San Francisco. And it was actually presented in 1875 to the citizens of the city by Lotta Crabtree, who was an entertainer of the time. But its notoriety nowadays is because after the 1906 earthquake, it was one of the few remaining landmarks, and people used it to meet up to reassemble their families.
I've been talking to Kimberly Lovato and Jill Robinson, the authors of 100 Things to Do in San Francisco Before You Die. My office used to be on Pacific, right near Montgomery. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'd walk up to Kearney and Columbus, and I'd always end up at Tosca.
Oh, yeah.
Tosca.
And when I was there, it was owned by Jeanette Etheridge, mm-hmm. And who I talked to all the time. What a great character. But if you were lucky, they'd take you in the back room.
Yeah.
And the back room had the pool table. And who was hanging out back there? Well, you had basically Francis Ford Coppola. You had Phil Kaufman, the guy who did The Right Stuff. Mm-hmm. You had all the filmmakers who lived in San Francisco, all the writers, all the producers. And what was really cool about it is that before you ever went there for drinks or even late night, you go across the street to City Lights Bookstore, mm-hmm. which, by the way, is like such an iconic place for great. And hard to believe that Lawrence Ferlinghetti, it's his 100th birthday.
Exactly. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
I mean, so you can just do that all in one block area.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the crazy part is you keep going up to Broadway, and there is the Condor. Let's talk about it. Carol Doda. Well, when I was here, she was a big item.
Oh, totally.
Oh,
it was a great stripper club, mm-hmm. right? Which, by the way, I only went in there once to interview her. I never actually saw the show. But the great story about that was the piano and the death. Do you know about the piano and the death?
I don't know that.
I've heard
this story, but I can't recall exactly how it happened.
The club had a piano that was on a riser. And so the woman who was stripping would be stripping on the piano, and it would be going up, right? And the guys could operate the elevator to make it go up and make it go down. Well, as it turned out, one night when the place was closing up, one of the strippers decided to have sex with one of the customers
oh.
on the piano. Mm. And in the act, they somehow activated the riser and it killed her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because
two things to
smush.
Do.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that was a good. Can I hear that again? Smush.
Smush.
Yeah. But I was up and there's the condor still there.
It is still there.
It's unbelievable.
I can honestly say I have not been in.
I haven't either.
One more thing to do.
Yeah, I guess
next
so.
Edition.
All right. So as an experience here, as a physical activity, what have you got?
Well, so the Beta Breakers is known as the foot race across San Francisco. That's known for kind of crazy costumes and sometimes no costumes. Something that's interesting about it.
Well, let's not talk about the Halloween parade on Polk Street.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, Beta Breakers is coming up in May.
It is coming up. It's usually the third Sunday of May. But something that, since we were talking about Lotus Fountain, something that we discovered in writing the book is the Beta Breakers started a few years after the 1906 earthquake. I think it was about 1912. And it wasn't named Beta Breakers at the time, but it was a way to kind of raise the city's spirits after the earthquake. So that was something that was really interesting. Being a Bay Area native, I didn't know that. And so in doing this research for all these little pieces, we learned a lot of things that we didn't know about events and places that we thought we knew quite well.
All right, but that's an event. But yep. I'm talking about, okay, for anybody coming at any other time of the year, you know, what is it that you can come do here that is quintessentially San Francisco?
I personally love sending people out to Land's End, which is in the northwestern part of the city. So people know...
It's on the water.
It's on the water. The Cliff House, people know
that. I've been to the Cliff House,
but there are so many beautiful walking trails that go down to little secret beaches, the Labyrinth on the beach. You can actually hike it all the way to the Golden Gate Bridge. It takes you through part of the Presidio, some of the batteries of the Presidio. And it's not a strenuous hike. I mean, some of the hikes down to the beach and back up might be a little strenuous, but you can walk along the cliffs and it's gorgeous. You have this view of the Pacific. It's sort of where the city meets the sea, and I love going out there.
Now, when I was first here, San Franciscans really loved their funny drinks. And you'd go to the Tonga Room at the Fairmont Hotel, and it was a tiki bar.
We still love them.
We still love tiki.
It's still there.
Oh, the Tonga Room's still there, but tons of tiki. I wouldn't say tons, but it's amazing how much San Franciscans love their tiki. A couple new ones just opened, I think, within the last 6 months. Yeah. Right around here, right around Union Square, I think Last Rites just opened. Yeah, people love their tiki.
And, of course, we would be remiss if we didn't acknowledge the largest Chinatown ever.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's a great place to walk around. I take my nieces there when they come in town. They love to walk around Chinatown.
For me, I love to walk around not just for the dim sum in the mornings. Mm-hmm. You know, like 11 o'clock in the morning, there's some great dim sum places, right? And they, you know how they do it. They count it by the plates. But you keep walking, they have the craziest stores.
Oh, yeah.
The craziest stores. I mean, forget the dollar stores you see in every other country. These are things you can find something not made anywhere else. And you go, I got to have six of them because they're so funny.
They are funny. And nowhere else in the city can you find them either. So, although out in the Richmond now is a little mini Chinatown going on, but shopping's all right. That's why my nieces love to go there. They love looking in those stores. They love eating the egg tarts. They love the dim sum.
Yeah, the famous egg tarts.
The famous egg tarts at Golden Gate Bakery. Yeah, sometimes they have them, sometimes they don't.
Get there early.
Sometimes even when they're early, there's just a sign that there are no egg tarts today. Sorry. It's like that Seinfeld episode. No soup for you. No egg tarts for you. You just never know.
When I was based here, you know, you had the legendary restaurants, right? At the Fairmont, you had at the Mark, right? The top of the Mark, and they're still around.
Yes,
I mean,
they are.
I mean, they haven't gotten rid of them, which I love.
Yeah, and San Franciscans.
Although at the Fairmont, they used to have Ernie Hector,
and his orchestra.
Had dinner theater.
Yeah, it's a shame they don't have that anymore. But San Franciscans are traditionalists in a way, so I'm glad that some of these places have stuck around.
And this year is the 80th anniversary of the Top of the Mark.
Yeah.
Wow. Great view.
Great view.
Absolutely.
Great martinis.
Well, after five martinis, it doesn't matter.
That's right. You can just get a room.
What's the longest standing bar that we know of?
Oh, gosh. That's a good question.
That is a good question.
I don't know.
I can't even remember the name, but I remember going to something that claimed to be the longest standing bar in San Francisco, and it was...
In South San Francisco, that one?
No, it was in the city proper, almost kind of financial district-ish, but it was, it's definitely, it's old. And I just cannot remember the name off the top of my head.
It's okay.
Do you know, Peter?
I don't. But it's got to be downtown. It's
yeah,
got
to be
close to the
so.
Embarcadero, I would guess, or even over by one of the piers.
Yeah.
You know?
I guess
could be. And we're not talking Pier 39. We're talking some of the earlier piers way before you get to the ferry terminal.
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah.
Where's the best place for breakfast for you guys? What's your hidden breakfast place?
Oh, I'm a brunch fan. I'm not a breakfast eater, but I love brunch. We have some great brunch places. One of the places I love that Jill actually introduced me to is called Outer Lands, and it's out by the beach. And we always meet there, and it's I love it because they just have fresh food. It's not crowded. It's a totally local place, a couple blocks from the beach, and they have this Dutch pancake that they cook in a skillet, and you can get it sweet or savory, and I'm not really a sweet person. I'm sweet, very sweet, but I don't like sweets, but I love the savory because they serve it with bacon.
And this is what was this eggs in jail time?
Oh, eggs in jail. They have eggs in jail there too, which is also great. This thick bread with the hole cut out of it, and then they fry an egg in it.
All right, so where are we going for lunch?
Yeah, let's go.
Where are we going for lunch?
We can go to, let's see, La Cumbre Taqueria
for a burrito.
To get a burrito, a mission style burrito, which is rather large, and sometimes I can't finish all of mine.
When I first came here, I discovered quite by accident, because I made a wrong turn, the Mission Rock Resort.
Oh, yes.
All the way down
in
the
place.
Old dockyards.
Yeah.
Crazy bad neighborhood.
I think it's dog patch it's, now. Yeah. Now it's trendy.
Getting better now, and that's where the new Warrior Stadium is being built.
Yep, Chase Center.
So get there while you can.
Get there while you can.
All right. And what about seafood?
Oh, you should. Well, you're a seafood lover. I'm sure you've been to Swan Oyster Depot on Polk.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you got to line up, but it's totally worth a seat at the counter for anything fresh there. I mean, they always have something fresh. I love the crab Louis salad, to be honest, but you can get oysters.
Well, I'm a little bit of a traitor. What I'll do is I'll go across the Golden Gate Bridge to Tiburon, to Sam's Anchor Cafe, to get the open-faced shrimp sandwich.
Oh, I haven't tried it.
There used to be. I really miss one place that's no longer there, the Swedish Bakery. Remember that? Swedish Bakery used to be there, and they had the most amazing chocolate-covered bananas. Mm. Oh, my goodness. They're gone. But Sam's is still there.
Sam's is still there, still popular on weekends.
Absolutely. What about dinner?
Yeah, again, always depends on what you like. I mean, we have great steakhouses. We have,
I mean, it's still
Tadich
in the seafood.
Grill.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's still in the seafood category, but Tadich Grill for the Chipino is...
For the crab Chipino.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's the old Portuguese dish from all the fishermen who started this thing.
That's right. That's right. The Italian and Portuguese on the wharf. Apparently, I don't know if it's true, but apparently they would just throw all their fish parts and not scraps, but into a bowl or a
pot. They were fish parts.
Fish parts. So it doesn't sound as appetizing as it tastes. It's
well, that's
very
why
good.
They do different levels different of the menu language,
now.
But it was fish parts.
Yeah. 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 This is why I don't write menus, Peter. Fish
no,
parts.
That's
doesn't
right.
sell.
Well, there's a whole science to the menu psychology.
I'm sure.
Oh yes. And what will move is what you describe it.
That's right.
You know, there's a chef once told me you can't put calf's liver on the menu. What you do is you say Aunt Tilly's calf's liver, and people go, oh, and then they buy it.
Okay.
So if you ever get to a menu and they say fish parts, you know the guy's an idiot. But it probably tastes pretty good.
Probably does.
And you're probably the only person who ordered it.
Chipino with fish parts.
And by the way, Tadich's has been around since the 1800s.
Oh, yeah. It's been around. I think it is considered one of the oldest, if not the oldest, in San Francisco. I don't know. I think there's some debate on that, but it's worth it. It still doesn't take reservations. That's one of my pet peeves about it. You have to wait with...
Or they got to know you. Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go. Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. Hard to believe this hotel was opened actually 14 years ago, 2005, and it looks just as new today as it was then. Great location, although when it opened up in 2005, this neighborhood didn't look anything like it looks like now, and it's such a walkable neighborhood now. So many different things to do. Joining me right now, you know, if you want to know something that's going on at the hotel, you don't necessarily have to ask the concierge. You don't necessarily have to ask, you know, the bellhop, but the person who sees everything is really the front desk. And joining me now, the director of the front desk right here, Felicity Wells.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, just to give everybody an idea of how Felicity got to San Francisco, she's from England, and then she held down these terrible jobs. Oh my God, just terrible. At the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C., and the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs, the St. Pancras Renaissance Hotel. I've stayed at that. Right there at the station, how they redid that station, and the most amazing story about how they redid that clock. It's just amazing. And now she's here in San Francisco as a transplant from England. How have hotel guests changed in your mind? Are they more demanding? Do they actually think they know more, or they demand more?
I mean, I would say the way guest travel has changed over the years. From my experience, obviously coming from a very different country, from England to America, you do see a little bit of a different travel.
By the way, I don't see a lot of demanding English travelers. They sort of like to queue a lot.
Right. We stand in queues, not lines. Yeah. Exactly. Yes.
And by the way, they'll say things like, could you tell me what time the room might be available in my lifetime? And thank you very much. And right. As opposed to the American traveler who would say, my room's not ready, and they basically want to take hostages.
Yeah, so, I mean, the American culture to the English culture is slightly different. I think as an American culture, they are more used to traveling, and travel obviously around a much larger country. So the demands are slightly different, I would say.
Although I will say, with your accent, you could probably tell me to go to hell and I'd probably say thank you. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about the English. Just you theoretically could just go bugger off. And you go, oh, okay, fine.
Right. No, it is nice to have the accent. I do sometimes hear that a lot.
You use it. Come on. could I help you please find another room because you're really bothering me?
It can be an advantage, absolutely. But no, it's really about taking care of each and every guest. I mean, that's our highest mission here at St. Regis.
But of course, it's more than just making sure there are enough towels in the room. People come in with some really unusual requests.
Correct.
Okay, in the time you've been here, mm-hmm. Give me one that you had, I have to do what?
So I could list many, but one that pops to mind. So typically we see a lot of leisure travelers in the summer. We transition, obviously, San Francisco is an amazing city for our tourists. And as we are located more in a business district of San Francisco, catering to children is something that we really transition our minds to in the summer. So what we did for one family, as we don't have a resort like property with a certain area for children, so we developed a scavenger hunt in-house for some children to do whilst they visited. So that was really fun. They got to go.
And none of the other guests were annoyed?
Well, it was very...
Uh-huh.
It was very, go to the pool, take a selfie, post it online, go down to the front door and get the name of the doorman, go and get a business card from somebody. So it was really a fun activity that we actually then implemented to have across all of our guests. So now we give it to all of our families at check-in.
How about the adults? Is there such a thing as an adult scavenger hunt?
You know, that would be a good idea. We should think about that.
And with enough alcohol, anything could happen.
Well, exactly.
I mean, right. But okay, that was cool because you had to adapt to the environment.
Right.
Right? Because you're not a resort.
No, so we're not a resort, but as I said, we transition quite heavily in the summer months. So June, July, August are typically our busiest months for leisure guests. And so we really do try to do some different activities for those guests.
But you can also send your guests on walking trips just anywhere near the hotel and they're going to find cool things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, San Francisco is such a fun city. There's so much to do. And we're in a great location for that. You can walk to a lot of easy places, very close to obviously Embarcadero and in the waterfront. So very well located.
What's really cool about the location here that most people don't know is it's not traditional retail shopping. You can walk to like factories and right. you can outlets that nobody even knows about or right. small mom and pop places where they manufacture luggage.
Right.
I mean, there's a guy up here who actually makes the best suitcases in the world. His name is Mr. Glazer, and it's called Glazer Design. And he doesn't really have a showroom. It's just like three or four blocks from where you just walk and knock on the door and you're like, oh my God,
right.
It's all handmade stuff, which you wouldn't find necessarily on Union Square.
Right, absolutely. No, there's a lot of hidden gems here in the city, which really makes it unique.
What's the biggest surprise for you in San Francisco? Because you're a relatively new arrival.
Right, I am. I've been here about a year and a half, so still exploring the city myself. In regards to a surprise, I mean, obviously, I would say something that always throws a lot of our guests off, and myself too, can be the weather. We talk about the weather a lot, but people come in the summer and expect to wear their flip-flops and shorts, and it's not like that here in those months.
Where are the wagons?
The wagon is too slow. Can't you ride?
It's not that he can't ride. How is it you put it home?
They're dangerous at both ends and crafty in the middle. Why would I want anything with a mind of its own bobbing about between my legs?
My next guest has one thing in common with the First Lady of the United States. They're both from Slovenia. However, she left 33 years ago and has really been in San Francisco ever since 1986. Her name is Floriana Peterson, and she's the author of 111 Places in San Francisco That You Must Not Miss. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
So here's my question. If you've been here for, you know, for 33 years, I'm assuming you've been everywhere in the city.
Yes.
And you've walked it.
Yes, especially the first year when I came here. I was very curious about the city. And also, I'm from Slovenia where everybody hikes. We are hikers. So I walked.
So this
I
was walked. And you walked all the hills too.
All the hills, all the stairs.
So when you in that first year that you were here, what was the biggest surprise about San Francisco for you?
The first year when I came here, weather. Of course, when I came here, I thought it's California. I brought summer dresses. I came here in January.
And you froze.
And I froze. So that was the biggest surprise.
But you started compiling notes about all the things that were new to you that turned out to be new to a lot of other people, too, because they hadn't seen it.
Exactly. Exactly. So in my 33 years, I really discovered so many places. I also talk to so many people, and everybody was always telling me things about San Francisco that I remembered. I like to listen to stories, and that's how I got to know many unknown secrets.
So give me one today that still ranks in your book as truly a secret, or that most people don't know about San Francisco.
Well, maybe what?
Well, for example, you walked the whole place, right? So you were in all the neighborhoods, you were all the communities, right?
Yes.
There's so many different neighborhoods and communities that people never see because they never get out of the downtown area or out of the Golden Gate Bridge area.
Yes, yes. So, what's was kind of surprising for me that every little part of the city has their own weather, their own culture. When you go to the Mission District, where it's mostly Latin district, it's very, very sunny, and you hear music from every window. People are outside, and then you go to the Pacific Heights, where it's the most wealthy community, and you never see anybody outside, or you don't hear music, and those kind of things are a little bit surprising.
When I lived here, I lived in Noe Valley, which had the best weather.
Best weather, and Noe Valley has those little farming streets, alleys, that you go, and you think you're in a little village.
Well, what I loved about Noe Valley, and it's still there today, they have a great cheese store, right? And oh my goodness, you don't go in there and ask for brie because they'll say to you, which ones would you like? They have like 25 of them.
Exactly. And the cheese store, it's owned by a Chinese man who grew up in Argentina. He doesn't have anything to do with Switzerland or France.
But it works.
The San Francisco. It's that mix of people and interests.
And of course, the one neighborhood that I've always wanted to live in San Francisco, which most people who were here would say, why would you want to live there? Because it's always so foggy, is Seacliff.
Oh, beautiful views.
Oh, my God,
Beautiful views, and the Land's End hike starts there, which is my favorite of the hikes. When you go, you start at Seacliff, and then you go to the Sutro Bath, but in between is this little walk down to the beach, very little beach that people don't know about it, and it's just beautiful.
I know. What's your favorite walk?
I would say the Land's End, and I love the stairs, all the stairs, Filbert stairs.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And the beach, the ocean beach. It's just
Dress warmly.
Dress warmly, yes.
Because it could be windy.
Yes, and I like dogs. So you can always, I don't have my dog anymore, so I go there and just enjoy other people's dogs.
That's like enjoying other people's children. You get to go home.
Yes.
And it works.
It works.
It absolutely does. Yeah. When friends of yours come to visit you, what's the biggest surprise to them about San Francisco?
The biggest, it's the hills. Everybody loves the hills and the views from the hills. But the biggest surprise, it's actually a sad surprise. It's the homeless. Nobody expects that's going to come to the richest city in the world and see kind of a third world scene there with unfortunate.
And it's still, and it's still a problem.
It's bigger than ever. Yes, so that's a surprise.
And hopefully something that can be done about it, because at the end of the day, there are resources, there are funds, there are spaces where people can, first of all, get a place to live, but then, more importantly, get a place to work so that they can be self-sustaining.
Exactly, exactly.
Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tokyo.
On second thoughts, let's not go to Camelot. It is a silly place.
Right. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air.
There are a couple of words and phrases that hotels use that I think are overused or misunderstood or misapplied, and everybody says it, right? If you're taking a tour of the hotel, they want to show you their fine dining restaurant. And, you know, like I was laughing, like, yeah, want to eat in your crappy dining room? And then my next guest is going to have to, I'm going to make him answer this question. Why is it that everybody who works at a spa whispers? They always go, you know, say, hey, how are you? I'm fine. I'm good. It's sort of like they're all in the witness relocation program. They don't want to know they're there, you know. But bottom line is, Randy Pierce knows all about this because he was working at the spa at the Ritz-Carlton in Orlando, where I used to go all the time. He's now the spa director right here at the St. Regis in San Francisco. Randy, what's changed in the spa business? Because in the old days, it was like, okay, you got your 60-minute Swedish massage, and maybe you had a facial, and you were done. That was it, right? Now you have a menu.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, some of it, and I would argue this, and you can certainly argue right back, some of it, on some spas, the menu is so out of control that it's almost like a stunt.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, it's like, really? You know, how many cucumber things can I have? You know, I mean, you've seen it happen at other spas.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've all done it. We've all done it. We learned our lesson.
What was the craziest one you had at a spa that you went, you finally said, enough already?
It got up to like 25 pages, you know, and after the price of paper got ridiculous, everyone was taking a spa menu left and right. You know, we had to cut it down and just, you know, go back to the basics. And
but what was the most elaborately stupid one you had, or that anybody had?
Oh, geez, I would have to go back to Vegas. You know, those big box spas, they just did everything for everyone, and you know, whatever concept you can come up with, they had it. You know, from children's spa treatments to elderly spa treatments, it was the whole gambit. Just anything that they could come up with, that whether it did anything or not, people wanted it, you know, especially in Vegas.
Because they wanted experiential one-upsmanship. They just wanted bragging rights to say, I had that treatment with the cardboard and the sandpaper.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, I think we've matured a lot in the spa industry, and we've reined ourselves in, and we know what people are looking for now.
All right, so let's talk about that. What lessons have you learned, and more importantly, what lessons have you applied right here at the St. Regis?
Well, it's all about the guests now. They've become more educated on what is, you know, what works now. The spa has become much more mainstream. You know, it's not just for, you know, your birthday once a year or, you know, for the ultra rich anymore. It's much more mainstream. The much more middle class, the millennials are getting into it.
Oh my God, no.
Yes, yeah. Believe it or not. A lot more gentlemen are going to spas more often because they're more concerned about their looks. So it's
and the treatments themselves?
Same. We're catering to a much broader range of guests.
But keeping it more simple.
Simplified, but more advanced.
Explain.
It's more about instant results, you know, because you don't want to have, it's not about the what we call the foo-foo treatments anymore, you know, and I think you know what I mean by that. It's about quality products that have results. Yes, there is still that foo-foo experiential aspect to the treatment. However, you're going to get the results that you're looking for. So if you get a facial, of course, it's still very relaxing and enjoyable, but you're going to walk out seeing the difference right then and there.
Okay, here's my biggest pet peeve at spas. You ready?
Tell me.
I don't want a facial at 1 in the afternoon. I don't want a massage at 2 in the afternoon. I want one at 10 o'clock at night, and then I'm done. When will spas stay open late enough and even charge me a premium so that, okay, you get your massage at 10 o'clock at night, and then you can slip into a coma? Because if I have one at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I don't want to slip into a coma at 2:30. I got stuff to do.
Totally understandable. Totally understandable. And we offer here at the St. Regis in-room massages for people at that time. We don't keep the spa open.
But you still do it. That's great.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
See, that's the key. People need to know it's like video on demand. It's spa on demand.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can basically manipulate your schedule that makes the most sense to you.
Absolutely.
The charge for looking at this pamphlet is $3. The charge for looking at this pamphlet and putting it back quickly is $4. Over the seas
and all the grease, to anywhere I please. As many times as I've come to San Francisco, I can honestly say I have not been to the museum I'm about to tell you about. It's a very young museum. It's only been open about 15 years. It's the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco, and the Director of Exhibitions and Curatorial Affairs, I love that, Curatorial Affairs, Emily Coleman, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, thank you.
I mean, it really is a young museum, isn't it?
Yeah.
15 years is nothing.
It's not.
Why here, and why did it open?
We really opened to create an institution focused on artists and people of African descent in San Francisco. This was
to showcase those local artists.
Absolutely. So this was really a foundational project for Mayor Willie Brown in creating an institution that was dedicated to people of African descent within the city.
And by the way, Willie Brown just celebrated his 85th birthday.
It's
unbelievable. I remember when he was the lieutenant governor. He's been everywhere.
Yeah, and he's still in San Francisco. I see him often.
He's still in this building.
Mm-hmm.
He has a residence in this building.
Yeah.
Amazing. So what's the biggest surprise about, first of all, where you are, how you exhibit it, and how people discover you?
I think people discover us on a whim, and it's always a really exciting discovery.
By accident.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when going around the Yerba Buena Arts District, not many people know that the Museum of the African Diaspora exists. However, as a contemporary art museum, we really showcase not only local artists, but also important contemporary artists today.
Now, what's also interesting about you guys, you are a non-collecting museum, so it means your exhibits are always changing out.
Yes.
So everything's on loan.
Everything is on loan, and currently we have, it's actually the last weekend of Black Refractions, highlights from the Studio Museum in Harlem.
And is any of it for sale?
It is not. That is something, as a nonprofit institution, we really leave sales to galleries and private collections.
So you're maintaining purity here.
We are.
Of the exhibits that you've done in 15 years, what's been the most interesting or surprising?
I would say one of the highlights is definitely Black Refractions, but we've also collaborated with SF MoMA in the installation of Portraits and Other Likenesses from SF MoMA. I curated a show called Toyin Oji Odutola,
Say that three times fast.
I can do it.
Go ahead, do it. Not a problem.
Toyin Oji Odutola. Toyin Oji Odutola. Toyin Oji Odutola.
Get a little rhythm going here and we can dance.
Okay. And that is a name that you should definitely remember. She had an exhibition here called A Matter of Fact, which then went on to the Whitney Museum in New York.
In New York.
Mm-hmm. And has really been a mainstay and a significant figure in the contemporary art scene.
In my experience and study of African artists, there's no middle ground. They are either determined to send a message mm-hmm. about their environment and their existence and their daily lives, or they're determined to show the way it was. But they're always sending a message.
I think all artists send a message. I think to focus.
But I'll talk about a clear message.
I don't believe that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
I mean, I think that similar to abstract artists who are not of African descent.
Oh, yeah, abstract I get. But what I'm talking about is if you take a look at Cuban artists, for example, mm-hmm. they're celebrating or essentially depicting a revolution and a struggle.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's always the case for Cuban artists in contemporary art practices. Like, I don't know if you would be able to see that in Mendieta's artwork, who does conceptual photography and performance.
Okay, you're educating me then. but the work that I've seen mm-hmm. or that has been displayed, and right. I go to Cuba all the time, mm-hmm. is either from the 1940s and the 1950s, you know, showing cigar girls mm-hmm. To, you know, the revolution under Castro.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are so many, you know, artists of diverse backgrounds, both in the United States and worldwide, who have, of course, different intentions with their art practices and different outputs.
But in terms of the African artists, obviously we have 54 different countries here. Mm-hmm. That's right. People don't realize there are 54 countries in Africa.
Exactly.
Right? So it takes a while for anybody, and you could speak from your own personal experience, to mm-hmm. be able to differentiate what they're bringing to the party.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, in similar ways that you can't pinpoint an artist from the different states of the United States. You often can't differentiate the different artists from specific countries.
Although a lot of those artists will be using different materials.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, my favorite ones are the artists of Ghana mm-hmm. and their coffins.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I died today in Ghana, the coffin, I would be buried in a 747.
You can see that.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah, and you can do that.
And they do it. Mm-hmm. But those are also not just coffins. They are pieces of art.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's been really important and have been included in important art exhibitions around the world.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.